I don't even know the difference between a good and a bad idea anymore. Sometimes I think an idea is amazing and it'll lead you astray, but I think that those paths are important. It'll take you somewhere you were probably supposed to go anyway.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I'll be speaking with some of the most innovative ideators in culture and trying to figure out how they make their creative decisions. This week, I'm talking to restaurateur Mario Carbone about how he went from being a line cook in Queens to a global culinary icon with dozens of restaurants around the world. This podcast is brought to you by the good people at Shopify. Feeling that entrepreneurial itch? Turn your passion into a business with Shopify. They've got everything you need to start, run, or grow your business. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. In 2008, as the financial crisis was rippling through the economy, an aspiring chef and restaurateur had an idea. Mario Carbone had sailed through culinary school and some of the best kitchens in New York City, but along the way felt something was missing. A dining experience that married the elegant culinary offerings of his schooling with the family-style Italian-American ambiance of his childhood in Queens, New York. So he and fellow chef Rich Terisi scraped together all the money they could and opened a tiny eatery named after Rich in Little Italy. Now, a little over a decade later, they own more restaurants than they had seats in that first venture. With these establishments scattered around the globe, Carbone, his partners, and their company, Major Food Group, are a certified dynasty. And it all started with one idea.
What was the role that food played in the culture of your family?
It was the meeting place, the place where you go at the end of the day to have, you know, dinner and talk about the day. Originally, it was my babysitter, right? I remember, my first babysitters were my grandparents. And as a little kid, if I wanted, they were always in the kitchen. So if I was with them, I was there. So there's like really early pictures of me with them, like one in the kitchen. And as I got older, they start throwing you little, tasks to do and help out. But I didn't realize that like we ate better than like my friends until like you start growing up and going to other houses. So you're so insulated. But food was very important to us as a family, and I think maybe we probably put a higher worth on it than I realized at the time, but exposed me to it.
What were like the regular dishes that were being served?
Depends on where we're eating. So my mother's side are Northern Italians and my father's side are Southern Italians. My father's side is also much more Italian American, and my mom's parents were born there. And then what we made in the house. So I kind of got exposed to lots of different variations and variables of recipes, but pretty quintessentially sort of Sunday sauce every Sunday, like religion. We made, big thing of pasta, stewing meatballs and sausages in the sauce, and having that sort of that end of the week Sunday supper at like 5:30. I don't remember a Sunday that went without doing it.
You started working in a kitchen at 14, 15 years old at the Clam Shack?
Yeah, like a local, the Crab Shack.
Crab Shack, yes. Yeah. Northern Boulevard.
Exactly.
How did you get that job and why?
My sister was dating a bartender there at the time. My sister's 4 years older than I am. And I was talking to my family about, wanting to, see if I can do this job. And my mom was, my mom just worries about things and like wasn't sure about it, but like this seemed okay. We knew someone there. It was Diana, my sister's boyfriend at the time, and that was the inn. So somehow that became my first job, and like it, what they were serving and how they were serving it was nothing. Like this was like a pro kitchen. And my first day, I remember I walked in, I met the chef, and he like took me towards the locker room, and he noticed that there were no more clean uniforms. So he just reached into the dirty hamper and pulled out a chef coat and handed it to me. from a place called the Crab Shack. So like someone's worked in that all day, and that was my uniform to wear all day, and that was my very first moment of a pro kitchen, like a commercial kitchen. And I'll never forget that, that dirty jacket. I think to succeed in this in a commercial way, you have to have obviously a love for food and hospitality and beverage, and there needs to be some sort of love for that. But then there also, you also need to have, you need to catch the bug of the business of it, the frenetic energy of it, the ragtag misfit group of people that are drawn to it, the speed of the tickets and the way in which a restaurant operates. Like, that's a totally different animal than I love food and restaurants and cooking. That's this other crazy commercial beast. And if you find love in both those things and you get a rise out of both those things, then you got a chance. But you need them both. So it was the exposure to the craziness that is our restaurant that I actually loved as well. You know, that sort of like the way Bourdain explains it, that sort of craziness of it, that cult that you have to love also. And that was my exposure to it.
How long did you work there before you decided it was time to go to culinary school?
I worked there in a bunch of other restaurants in the neighborhood. I worked at a country club one summer. I did a bunch of odd food jobs. And then when I got to graduation, really my two paths were community college or actually try this. And I think in hindsight, I had the clarity of thought to know that with my aptitude for scholastics and what I was going to be able to get into and how I was probably going to apply myself or lack thereof in this, because I have just tremendous apathy. I was just never a good student. Like, I just blame apathy. I just didn't have any interest or care or desire to focus on this thing at all. So I was lucky enough to have clarity of thought in that moment to say, the pursuit of this is going to lead to nothing but mediocrity. The pursuit of this is a great unknown and kind of a starting place. You can start over here and from day one, reapply yourself to this, what I looked at as a vocation. This is a thing that I'm going to learn how to do with my hands that I'll always know how to do and I'll always be able to make a living. Go after that and put real effort, maybe effort that you didn't put into this or you never put into this, and challenge yourself in this next phase of your life to go after this. You're starting at the same place everyone else will start at. While here, I'm behind. You know, I'm going to go to some, you know, generic place, and I'm going to put some sort of generic effort into it, and I'm going to get a generic result. So, you know, the path of least resistance versus the great unknown.
Did your parents support this decision?
They did. I know, and I remember fear in them. You're not going to real school. You don't have a real degree. You don't have anything solid to fall back on. What are you going to make of yourself? And even my grandfather, who wasn't a professional chef, his job was actually to fix the equipment in professional bakeries. So he knew the commercial world, and even he, who loved me to pieces, showed concern to his daughter, my mom, and that continued to freak them out. So they were worried about the idea that you're not going to get a real diploma out of anything you're doing right now. So that didn't feel great, but you know, I pursued on.
What was the most important thing you feel like you got out of that experience being at CAA?
I think for me, it was another personal test. The neighborhood restaurants at 15 didn't dissuade me. They only encouraged me. This big, shiny school where supposedly the best and brightest go did not dissuade me. Yes, there were more difficult moments than others, but ultimately I made it through, and what's on the other side is an even greater ambition. That's telling me something about me and this path. Every moment of any adversity I took on in a way that I had not taken anything else on in my life. There wasn't any apathy. There was only determination and blinders. So it was, as the years were passing and the personal tests were being passed in my mind and in my body, I was getting the affirmation that this was the right thing to do. And I was applying the work ethic that I saw every day in my parents. I was finally applying that, and it was paying off.
Obviously, the networking also was very valuable in that you met one of your partners in that. Do you feel like that the time in school did set you up as you went out into the world trying to meet other chefs and, you know, sort of start your career?
I think meeting Rich the first day of orientation was the single best thing to come out of school. It was such a significant moment of my life. I met my professional life partner, right? And he and I, with my partner Jeff, have built this thing together. So everything else that happened there just sort of paled in comparison to what became this amazing moment of meeting him. At the time, we didn't know, right? It would take 10 plus years for that to grow into this thing that we got to here. We never would have considered it otherwise, but over time, that was what that relationship blossomed into.
What kind of exposure growing up did you have to fine dining?
Zero. The fanciest restaurant that we went to when we went to celebrate, like in Queens, looked like Carbone. You know, like when I close my eyes and I remember those restaurants, many of them are still there. They felt like that place, which makes that all the more significant to me years later that we do that. But that was fancy. You know, I could not have fathomed in my teens anything beyond that. I didn't even know it existed, to be quite honest. Not until there was a great program called Great Chefs of the World, which was like a PBS channel, and it was just a chef in a kitchen. You could hear the hood on behind him. It was real quiet, and it was first, it was Great Chefs of America, and then it became Great Chefs of the World. And like my generation of chefs all obsessed over that show. And you got to see like these guys in their kitchens early on, Charlie Palmers of the world, and like this generation that was like right before me. And I would get home from school and I'd watch that in the basement. Some of those memories.
As you're seeing more and more things, experiencing more and more things, how does your sort of vision for what a restaurant should be start to change?
I was always that guy that like kept notes. I'd make up fake restaurants in my notebook on my free time. I would you know, create concepts. So I'd write menus. I started playing in all the arenas that I actually work in today. By like starting to learn about the different Chinas and you know, I remember going to Babo right before I started working there. I went there the night before my first day with my girlfriend at the time, and it was it had just gotten a 3-star review. It had just gotten best new restaurant in the country, and he was playing License to Ill cover to cover. And my mind was blown. Like, it was this fancy restaurant playing Beastie Boys cover to cover, really loud, making his version of Italian food. And the whole thing was just one of those nights that just changed, like, it just changed my perspective on this industry. I couldn't believe this place existed. It was crazy to me.
Now fully committed to his culinary path, Carbone was determined to do what it took to get to the next level. So he moved to Italy to learn more about his roots and the accompanying food, and brought those experiences with him when he later reconnected with classmate Teresi, as the two stepped into the unknown to launch something of their own.
You start the internship. Shortly thereafter, you end up getting an opportunity to move to Italy.
Yeah.
How did that happen, and what did you learn while you were there?
I started to realize through working at these Italian restaurants that what I knew of Italian food was actually Italian-American food, and I needed to know, I wanted to know more about the origin of some of this. So when that finally hit me, which took till my late teens, that I realized that what I was really eating wasn't actually Italian food. It was a New York creation that my family had adopted. So I wanted to go see where it came from. So I went to Mario and I asked if there was connections he could make, and he put me in contact with an author who lives in Rome. Her name is Faith Willinger, and Faith gave me a few options of where he thought I might be comfortable.
These are just restaurants that she knew of?
Yeah, they were restaurants that she knew of, and families that she knew that ran the restaurants. And I wound up just kind of cold choosing one, a restaurant called La Dogana, which is in northwestern Tuscany, a family and a restaurant that's still really close to me. Through the years, I've sent my staff to go train there, and they basically live in the room that I lived in, and they work at the restaurant I worked at, and they do my old job, and they get a little sense of where that comes from. But easily one of the most significant moments of my life is the year plus that I lived in Italy, middle of nowhere, really no English being spoken. The most quintessential mom and pop restaurant you could possibly imagine.
What were the biggest differences in the sort of food preparation from what you had come to know as Italian food in Queens?
This was really that it was farm to table before that was a concept that really we were recognizing here in the States. It was, you know, waking up in the morning and going with the chef to the fish market, meeting the guy who raises the pigs, meeting the person who makes the cheese, having them come to your doorstep, you going to theirs, really starting to get a better understanding of the cycle of life. And then really understanding the fierce regionality that they cook in, but not just them, basically the entire world, certainly all of Europe, everyone cooks with this sort of fierce regionality, and learning his box, right? Learning what they consider their food, and understanding the rules there and understanding why those are somewhat important to adhere, and getting a better sense of how this man and this place goes about it. And that really taught me a lot about where it came from for me. And then it became a source of inspiration, and the idea of the box becoming this thematic set of rules became a mantra that I live my whole life by, really.
Tell me a little bit about the box.
The box is super important to me. You know, I think I don't have a mind or maybe an interest in outside the box. I think that certainly immensely important that that exists in the world. And I am very envious of people that are able to have these sort of abstract thoughts and create something new, push a boundary outside of its normal walls. My mind works thematically very much inside a box. So what I like to do at this point is, depending on the project or the topic or the conversation, maybe there's a set of rules that already exist. That's an amazing scenario. You know, an example of that is us redoing the old Four Seasons restaurant. There's a set of innate rules there of what we're going to build and how we're going to build it, and a story that needs to be told because it's effectively a functioning museum. We need to keep this in this place. So here's your parameters. And sometimes I'll create a story so that story sets the box and sets the parameters. I operate that way because I think that it's very much theater. I'm aware that I have a different set of guests every night that come to these places, all looking for a similar experience. So for us to set a very definitive stage, and that stage means everything, for me that stage means everything from what they're wearing to how they're serving it to what the music is to what the color scheme is, to set that stage so that the ultimate goal is when that guest walks in the door, I've taken them to this state, to this place, the place that we set. And I believe the only way to do that is to adhere to a really strict set of rules as to how we're going to go about that. If we're saying that this restaurant is a homage to the first generation Italian Americans in New York, which is what Carbone is, then that and that wouldn't exist. But this and this would. So let's make sure that we're never diverting away from the story that we're telling. Because as soon as you do, you lose your audience. They're gone. They're out. They don't believe it anymore. So I'm trying to make something really real and really believable. This place really existed back then. We're really in an old Little Italy. This building really is as fucked up as it looks. Tell the story, stick to the rules. You know, stick to the rules of my story. And then I can train in that so that when a chef is working and I'm not there and he makes something, I believe after all is said and done, they'll know if it fits inside the box. Okay, that worked or didn't work for these reasons. Those reasons are the set rules.
When do you feel like the aperture sort of opened for you and you were able to get sort of philosophically from prepping this dish within this meal to thinking about the sort of more macro experience that you were offering?
I think I was just lucky to be close to the source early on. As a young student, I was always never far from the decision-making process. Not that I was part of it, but I got to see it. Sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you're trying to absorb all these things, and I want to know why this great chef got here. How did he get here? And try to understand that and get really close to the source and ask smart questions and do everything I didn't do in traditional schooling and really become a student of the masters, become a student of the classics. In all ways, in all, you know, at this point, I touch lots of forms of art to create a restaurant, from pottery to music to silver making to crocheting of cloths. I'm talking to artisans all the time. So I want to have a deeper understanding of these traditional techniques and reasons why and get to these sources so that it's not what I call a yard sale. It's just like a bunch of shit put together because I like it. Because that is an acceptable answer for me as the boss. Why? Because I said so. Why? Because I like it. That's not gonna grow a disciple. You grow a disciple. We chose this because of this. Let me tell you why. Because this person made this in this style for this reason, and that works here in this room because I think because of that reason, and the story I tell, and this box that I make. So at the very least, you know, I'm not egotistical. I don't believe that. My team is going to stay forever. Many of them have, but they're going to go on and they're going to leave, just like I left all these places and all these people. Although I stay in great contact with them, hopefully I'm giving them something to take with them. I took something great from all these people, and I'm just trying to apply something of my own for the company, but also for the people that are interacting with it. They get to take it with them.
What were the most important steps that you had to take? I mean, obviously, you had a 10-year career leading up to the opening of Terisi. What happened between graduating and those first internships and the time in Italy until that sort of prepared you for opening your own places?
It was really just a pursuit of working at an excellence level. So I tried not to focus too much on the cuisine, although I did try to make sure that I had a pretty rounded background. I did traditional French with Danielle. I did traditional Italian in Italy. I did a new style of this creative Italian here in New York. I had a foundation of what I remember as the food that I ate. I did molecular gastronomy with Wiley DeFranco. I tried to make sure that I was a pretty well-rounded chef. Because I was always afraid of not having the answers later, of a young chef coming to me the way that I went to these great, great masters and not being prepared, not having the answers, not inspiring anybody with the decisions that I made and the choices that we make and ultimately failing, right? It's a fear of failing and not, you know, how do you not succeed in your own city? You know, how do you not give New York something? for all it's given you, you know?
How did you know you were ready?
I don't think you get to know. I don't think you ever get to know. I think you get to a point where you've built up enough confidence in your experiences. And I know that I was as sure as I was going to be at that point, but man, is it scary. Like, to take that leap. I remember telling my, you know, I was working as like the second or third in command at Del Posto, which was at the time the fanciest Italian restaurant that New York had ever seen. And my parents went there and they got to eat there and they were so proud of this place and that I worked there and I had a relatively, you know, important job there. And then the day that I left, I told my mom and she was visibly upset. I don't know if she was upset because of the unknown that what are you gonna do now? But I believe that she was upset partly because she really couldn't tell anyone anymore that I worked there or for that chef. And I remember getting that reaction and it burning me, because that meant you didn't think I could be better than that. And I know that she didn't mean that, but I used it as this fuel and like, wait till you see what I fucking do. You have no idea yet what I'm gonna do with this family name, you know? And like it gave me this shot of like, wait, just wait. The Terese opening was a product of, we had hit this sort of 2008 recession.
Which was devastating for the industry.
Devastating for the industry, and certainly for young upstarts who have yet to prove their name as entrepreneurs. You know, the position that I was in, I need to get investor money somewhere. Yeah. I have this dream. I don't have any money. I have all this experience. I think I can do something special. And then that happens, and it just dries up, right? So now there's no one that's going to give an unproven 29-year-old kid any money to open a restaurant right now. At the time, my roommate happened to be rich. He was in between, he was working for somebody else and I was working for someone, and then we wound up, because neither one of us had any money, sharing a studio loft apartment on Waverly. So he's my roommate, and at night we would bounce ideas off each other. I'm gonna do this, yeah, I'm gonna do like that. Yeah, 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 that's cool. And we'd help each other. And then 08 happened, we had similar ideas, and there was a moment of, listen, if either one of us is going to never have another boss again, the only way to do this is if we do it together. Like, let's take the little bit of family money that you got on your side and the little bit of family money that I got on my side and a couple of friends who want to throw in, and let's find the tiniest little thing and let's just take a shot. And that's what we did. We decided to join forces, and it was that moment that forced that. We had never considered it prior. We would have never considered it prior. You don't tag team chefs, right? But it was, we were so determined to be entrepreneurs and be our own bosses that we took that shot. And we opened a 400 square foot restaurant on Mulberry and Prince and rolled the biggest set of dice we ever had. Because not only was it rolling the dice on succeeding or failing, it was both our blue collar families, all they had. Like we talked about earlier, I sort of love when there's built-in knowns. Here's what I know about this. I've only got this much space, I only got this much money, I've only got these three pieces of equipment. Cool. I can work around these constants now, right? If I can do anything I want, anywhere I want, anytime I want, like, my brain don't work. It doesn't work. I can't work like that. So I have these constants. And then we had a major moment where he and I were just riffing one day on the beginning of this, and we had a major breakthrough of looking within and sort of saying, because when we first started sketching ideas and menus, it was very much tracing our old bosses. We were writing it and there was no conviction. We couldn't find our voice yet. And we had kind of dawned on a moment of like, that's not us. Like, we're writing these menus in Italian. We were both born in New York. We had this sort of inflection moment of, I think what we need to do is is take the philosophy of this strict regionality of Italian cooking, but European cooking, take this philosophy of strict regionality and apply it to the region that is New York, to us. Make this food us. And then we started making beautiful, interesting, unique dishes that only could come from that moment in time. We started creating things, and it just freed up the way that we could work. And we were no longer tracing. We were starting to write our own new music. And it was a really beautiful moment that then we were able to apply as we grew.
Things were pretty modest when you first opened the door.
Selling sandwiches and like sides of vegetables. I made one little lasagna every day. Rich made chicken cutlets. Like it was like cooking in grandma's kitchen. And then at night, because of the limitations that we had, we only had a chalkboard menu because we didn't have a big enough refrigerator to hold food. We didn't have enough staff that we couldn't give out a menu. I couldn't afford to buy all those ingredients. What I could do was make one menu. I'll buy just this much fish tonight. I'll buy just this much this tonight. This is what I can do. So the limitation was the propelling moment into this style that we were forced into adopting, but became the thing that we adopted. And so through this chalkboard menu, we went hard on it. We were like, all right, you know what? Let's change this menu every day. Every day we're going to write a new menu. And we charged $45 for the whole menu. And you sat down and you had no choice. You just had to eat what we gave you. And for a long time, when we first did this, people would come in, they'd look for a menu. We'd say, this is what we're serving tonight, and they'd walk out. And that happened night after night after night. And it took a while until that got traction. But it was our hand being forced into that caused this huge creative boom for us, where we wrote this menu every day. And we, through writing the menu every day, we found this rhythm of who we were as a team, he and I, and as chefs of New York. It was a beautiful process.
Have you ever had a big idea but lacked the tools to implement it? Look no further than Shopify. Shopify is the brand that powers all your favorite clothing, beauty, and sneaker brands and offers the best-in-class commerce tools to allow you to sell online, in person, and on all major social platforms. Shopify fuels millions of entrepreneurs and turns ambition into action. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Now back to the story. On the heels of their early successes, the major food group would further expand, building their empire atop another Italian concept, the aptly named Carbone. Soon, early goals of creating a new New York City classic evolved to worldwide restaurant openings as Carbone juggled his roles as chef, entrepreneur, teacher, and business partner.
Shortly after opening Teresi, you meet the gentleman who would become your third partner. Can you tell me, how did that happen?
So Jeff Zlaznik, he's another New Yorker. We sort of swam in similar circles, but we never really knew each other. He was in the food world. He like went to school to be a banker and hated it, started the hospitality path, working in hotels, and knew a lot of the same people that we knew. But he had the ambition of being a restaurateur. And not being a trained chef, he always knew that he was going to need to help. He was going to need to find people to do that with. And he had caught wind of Teresi opening and what we were doing there, and that it was gaining some traction and some buzz. And he was an early customer and a frequent customer of ours. He knew the girl that ran the door, so like he got in all the time. And one night he was just like, he made a reservation. He was like, can you tell Mario I'd like to like have a drink with him after work? And so we did, and we went out that night to the Jane Hotel, and we drank together for a few hours, and we sort of professed our love and interest for the future of what we were doing. And he was asking me what we wanted to do next, and I was trying to gauge what he wanted to do in general for the industry, and we were both talking really about Carbone. without knowing it. That was what he really wanted to do, and it was what we thought was the next smart move off the back of Terezi being this little baby interpretive thing that we wanted, that we did. It was Italian-American forward thinking, and this was the traditional restaurant that I knew from my childhood. And when that seemed to line up, I went back to Rich and I was like, yo, this guy, I think he could help us, because we were just two chefs. We didn't know. I was writing checks, trying to figure out how to balance the checkbook and vendors, and we didn't know what we were really, we were figuring it out, and we would have figured it out, but like he was gonna come on and like be the other partner that we could really pass some of that on to. We're learning all collectively as we grow, like how to run this as a business just really isn't something you can teach. Yeah, you can go to school for it and learn some of the mathematical equations that are used to standardize the percentages of food costs and labor, but like you got to just do it. And there's a lot of lumps that go into that. So it was nice to have someone to take some of the brunt of that from us. Because we only had 3, 4, 5 employees. So Rich and I woke up 4:30 in the morning, we got there, we made everything, we did everything, we were there all day. So to do anything else to keep this thing afloat was borderline already too much. So he came at the right moment at the right time, and he felt like someone that could help us. We had no idea that what we were basically stumbling into was like the perfect person for us. We're challenging each other all the time. Jeff comes in, if I've been working on that dish for 6 weeks and Jeff comes in and takes a bite and is like, I think it's terrible. It's a start over. You know, first it's a blow. It's a blow to your ego, but like, it's a start over. And like, sometimes it's butting heads. Like if we're not overly sensitive with each other, we'll get to a better end game. The three of us together, pushing each other and pushing the team, pushing the idea, the sum of its parts will rise to the top.
I was gonna say, I mean, the life of a chef is notoriously brutal, from the hours, physical toll that it takes on you, and of course, you know, leading up to that, to ultimate success, money as well. Were there any points in your 20s where you just felt beat down or like burnt out by all of that?
You get run down. It's a tough job. There's a lot of hours involved. And when you're at the highest level, there's criticism, there's your general competition around you. I mean, when I was a cook, there was real competition. You had to keep your job. You had to fight for your job if you're working at the highest level. You had to prove yourself. It was exhausting. Never doubt, though. You know, never. Did I choose wrong? Was this not intended for me? I think never really was that in doubt through my 20s. It was always, I understand this is part of the journey. I understand this is the path. This is what'll make me great. This is really hard right now, and I think it should be. I think it's supposed to be. That's what I chose.
Take me through sort of the process of development from Terezi to Parm to then Carbone.
Parm was one of those things where like your neighbor goes out of business and things are going really well, and you're like, all right, let's keep it rolling. Like, should we take that space? And that was just when Jeff got on board and we were like full of piss and vinegar. And we're like, let's do more. And we took the space next to us. We stumbled through that build out. We lost some money along the way. We really did. We had bad contractors. We had guys, you know, shaking us down. It was a struggle getting this little thing open. We finally got it open. I think back then we were already thinking, oh, this is gonna be the rollout plan. You know, this is the McDonald's for us. We're still trying with this one. That was just a growth off of Terezi. And then the real next big moment was when this space became available. This felt giant to us. You know, like Terezi was 16 seats. And we walked in there and we were like, shit, this place is huge.
It's 100?
It's 80 seats.
Okay.
it was the first time we were going to hand out a menu. We don't have any menus. We're going to hand out a menu and people are going to choose. It was the first of a bunch of things. And then I remember, you know, through Jeff and through some people that we had met over the course of the first few years of the company, we had put together a nice roster of investors. And this thing was getting kind of fancier and fancier as we were building it out to finally where we opened. And I remember a real sentiment from journalists and sort of the public at large of, who do you think you are? Like, you, these kids who open this nice little sandwich shop, you're charging 50 something bucks for a veal parm and you're trying to make it real fancy and you got all these tablecloths and fancy china and like, don't you know Il Molino's down the block? That was a real heavy sentiment that was coming our way when we first opened. And when you open a restaurant in New York back then, you get all the critics, they come right away. With the last one being the New York Times, being the biggest one, the one that I've read every Wednesday since I was a kid, that I wanted to be in since I'm a kid, New York Times. So they all start, New York Mag, Time Out, they all start coming in and writing their reviews. And the reviews were shaky, man. The reviews were shaky at times.
Really?
New York Magazine trashed us. And the reviews were all over the place. And finally, we waited for the Times to come in, being the last one. And they wrote a just beautiful, glorious piece on the restaurant. And it was a huge exhale. We had a massive party. The staff was crying. I remember, like, everyone was so bought in on this thing that we were all just waiting for the Times to come and tell us we were worthy, and make this Italian-American thing legit. Like, they kind of legitimized it with the review that we got.
What were the critiques that you were getting from the sort of more negative reviews?
It was that sort of who do you think you are sentiment that we were probably much easier to love when we were slinging $10 sandwiches. But when the very same people who were taking the very same approach to something here in a really short period of time, that same critic who loved you here is going to doubt you here. And that was a mind fuck for us. We're like, wait, didn't you just say like all those nice things about us? Like, it's still us. That thing that we did there, I just applied to this here. Like, this is who we are. This thing, like that, this is who we are. This is New York. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand the pushback. Maybe they weren't ready for us to be here. So they were slowing down the rate of our ascent. I wasn't sure. I didn't get it. And you can't help but to have doubt creep in. Do I not belong doing this? Should I not be charging this? Should we not be doing it like this? Maybe we should have just made more Teresi's, you know? It starts to spin. So to get affirmation from the highest level was a massive relief and vindication and propellant on a world stage.
Were the reservations, was it packed out from the moment you opened it off of, you know, the reputation you guys had built?
We were full. We were full from the beginning because it was the new cool thing. It was the new restaurant. People had heard about Teresi, but maybe they didn't get to go because it was so small and we didn't take reservations. And we had a really good investor base at that point. We had gotten good people behind us and they had people. So they were coming in and bringing people. And buzz was starting to come, but it was like, it was the new buzz. It was the let's go try the thing buzz. There wasn't real feet in the ground, at least I didn't feel, until we had gotten through that breakthrough moment where we're not going anywhere. We're not just a new thing. Like, it's going to be here. You know, the clubhouse thing that followed, I really wouldn't have guest. I've never been a part of anything that consistently does the same number of customers every single night, no matter what's going on in the world. It's really pretty unbelievable.
At what point in your thinking about Carbone did the sort of theatrical element come into focus?
I knew the theater of it. I was just emulating the restaurants that I knew, right? The ones that I had grown up going to, the ones that I was going to for research, and I'm watching. I'm trying to put the scene of the movie together in my mind and figure out, all right, that guy does that move over there, and that's like that, and uniforms, and yeah, and I'm just trying to put it all together, because I did want it to be so real. The last thing I wanted to have happen was to make what we do a shtick. It wasn't Disneyland.
How do you walk that line between being authentic and playing into the sort of expectation, but also not becoming a cartoon?
I think having it be built from that sort of that place of classic, right? For the same reason that, you know, it's like Karate Kid painting a fence and not knowing why, right? Like you've gone through the training, you've worked with all the masters. Now take Restaurant Danielle's approach to service and apply it to Gargiulo's that you remember going to, you know, apply it for how you want to express yourself, and then make it, work backwards now. Now, okay, make it from there. You know, set up your kitchen, train your wait staff, order your china, you know, go through the process, trusting your training at that point, and put the pieces back, break it up and put it back together in the best way possible with the best intentions, with this theater in mind. And I think you'll get a great result.
Carbone now a success. How did the three of you start to think about growing and creating new brands from there?
I think it was sometimes misguided enthusiasm. I think you get to you start to think, whoa, I can make anything. Like they're gonna love this. Like I got a couple hits under my belt, and you start just. Opportunities start to come your way from developers, investors, friends. I got a guy who's got a space, got a thing, or someone from out of town's like, I want to bring this Carbone to here. And, you know, the entrepreneurial bug of wanting to grow, okay, let's build a company. You know, we got some wins under our belt, got some recognition. Took lumps along the way, like not being able to conjure up the same emotion because you didn't get every detail totally right, maybe. The difference between good success and movie quality transportation are huge gaps. When we started to be somewhat fragmented in our growth, where I don't see Rich every day, and I didn't see Jeff every day, and I didn't have my team with me, and we were kind of like what I called no huddle offense, right? Like we're not regrouping here. We're running, gunning. I got the plays on my arm. We're going. Doesn't yield movie quality. So through some stumbles of you know, we gotta, you know, we open that, but we gotta turn it a little bit because it's not being received this way and like not nailing things sometimes. Even though the doors are staying open, you know, you could have done that a little better. It proved over time to teach us about how we're gonna grow later. It didn't stop the growth. It taught us how to grow. And today we're even though we're a bigger company and arguably going faster than that first growth period back then, we're doing it in a way that is much better for what the end result is. It's going to yield a product that is on par with us in our rookie season, you know, like that level of just enthusiasm and collectiveness and how tight we were. How do you do that when you get bigger? So it was that lumpy growth that got us to a place today where it's much more fluid.
As you guys started to scale, how were you able to maintain integrity across the brands?
You're not. So once you like absorb that idea, it's not gonna be the same as when we all worked in this little room and we did it ourselves. Now there's two of these rooms and three of these restaurants, and one's actually over there in that part of the city. And now one's actually in another city. And now one's over there. So initially you gotta make peace with the fact that I'm not gonna touch every plate tonight. So how do you...
Is that hard as a chef and as...
Yeah, it's really hard. So now you're relying on someone that you directly taught. All right, I'm gonna teach them how to do that there. And initially, again, no real playbook on how to do this. Those growth moments are really, really hard. Being an individual restaurateur, being a small business owner, has its own difficulties. And then as you grow and you entrust others with your message, you know, right now, somewhere in the city, there's a waiter I've never met delivering a dish of food that I probably created years ago, and I'm entrusting this person that I may never meet to speak about it and understand it and deliver it the way I want, and represent what we do. So at some point you fall back on being the craftsman and you become the teacher. You know, I still like to get my hands in it. I still very much like to cook and be with the team, but my job is...
How frequently do you still do that?
I'm very involved in the openings. I'm part of the opening team and I go from restaurant opening and city to city. And then I believe that my best use now is as a consumer, is just put myself in the place of a consumer, be there, experience it, take notes, go over what my findings were with the team. But being in the kitchen it's tough. It's tough to be in these kitchens. You know, I when I'm in New York, I try to make it a point to be in the kitchen at Carbone and, you know, those sort of flagship places that need the highest level standards. But then I get there and I'm always pretty well surprised at how well it's being run and how great of a job, you know, this team is doing. And but it's very hard. There's no playbook.
You have a number of other restaurants. Have any of them opened and been somewhat more rocky or more challenging?
Yeah. You know, we've opened restaurants that have not worked right away, that we've had to sort of, and it's tough for the restaurant. You can't, it's hard to rebrand it, to reposition it. You are kind of what you are when you open. We've had places we had a place that was a huge success when we first opened, and then we started seeing diminishing returns year over year. The neighborhood was changing. This place that was full of life slowly starts to deteriorate, and it's hard to stop. It's a giant ship. You know, it's very, very difficult to move its pattern and move its trajectory when it starts going that direction. And you do everything you can. You try specials, change the menu, change the colors, whatever you do to try to keep it going. But momentum's either your friend or it's coming down for you. You know, I mean, it can go in the other direction, and we've certainly felt both of those things.
I was going to say, with Teresa, you switched after opening this to like a 22-course tasting menu. What happened? Like, how did that go?
It went well. It was in hindsight, it was probably a bit egotistical and something that, in hindsight, it was something that I think we were chasing. Yeah. Like, that was a thing then. Like, there was a few places that were doing these crazy long tasting menus. And uncharacteristically of us, I think we chased that also. We wanted that.
Well, as a chef, there's a certain regard that comes with that, right?
Yeah, it was those places that were doing that thing were being known as amongst the best, and we were chasing that. I think we were chasing that spotlight a little bit. What the end result of the product of that tasting menu was beautiful. We made this love letter to New York, and we put a shit ton of effort into every bite of food that we did for that menu. I remember some of them super vividly, and like the thought process that we went into all of those things. But in hindsight, we were chasing. And I think about that sometimes when I'm up against a certain decisions to choose this direction or that direction. But I'm glad we did it. It definitely informed me, at least, about how I want to make decisions going forward. But Teresi was looking for itself again. You know, that place kept reinventing itself, deli into chalkboard, into long tasting menus. It kept reinventing itself, which was beautiful, but also constantly upsetting the base. You know, no one really knowing what they're going to find there. And now we're finally going to get a chance to move it to a much more formal space up the block on Mulberry. And relaunch it later this year, which will actually be a really beautiful thing to do. I'm glad that that'll happen.
What's the concept?
It's the original idea.
Okay.
It's a 10-year older, more thought out version of the first one. You can never write your first album again, right? There's a beauty in the first time you put yourself out there, and that also being the consumer's first time of them consuming you as a product. That moment, like courting someone, that sensation, you can't replicate again. So we shouldn't chase that. You'll fail 100 out of 100 times. You're not gonna get that back. Appreciate that moment in time. It's never coming back. So with that said, and that off the table, what's it gonna be? So we're gonna try to put it back in a similar manner with a similar philosophy. But it should be 10 years older. You know, I don't wanna wear the trend from 10 years ago and just try to like conjure up a last shot of like playing that song again. Like, we should be better than that. What is better than that? Challenge the team. What's better than that?
What do you see as next for yourself and the Major Food Group?
I don't know, which is really exciting. We have lots of opportunities. I want to be thoughtful in what we choose. I want to be thoughtful in the paths that we choose. I think hospitality as a whole is still a really big idea. What does it mean? What's it mean for us to be a hospitable company? How can we chart new courses along the way? The success is unclear. I think that it's important for us to continue, just like we started, putting ourselves in uncomfortable positions. You find yourself in a room with these brilliant people, and you're like, wow. Today I can do something I couldn't do yesterday. Today I can do something I couldn't do last year. Today I can do something I couldn't do 10 years ago. Because what we've built, the snowball of what we've built, is the sum of these amazing parts. And holy shit, if I engage in all of these amazing parts and people that are around me now, we could do it. We could do anything. Like, what would you like to do today? You know, and that amazing gift that's been given to us through the corner of hard work and luck, to have that now at our disposal means that the future is unknown, which is a beautiful place to be, I think, for us.
While talking to Mario, I realized that there wasn't just one thing that made him the entrepreneur that he is today. Yes, he had ambition, but he also knew to humble himself and learned his craft from his culinary OGs. And yes, he had the ego necessary to create on a stage as large as New York City's restaurant scene. But he also knew what he didn't know and armed himself with partners that bolstered him. Perhaps most importantly, he has a vision for his restaurants, and he's never wavered on that, even in the face of challenge and uncertainty. I wondered if he ever thought things might not work out.
Do you ever doubt yourself?
Every day. Every single day. I think doing something scary means that there's doubt. But that doubt is the roller coaster you've accepted. That's the rush you're looking for. And I think putting yourself in those uncomfortable places means that there's doubt. So I think embracing the beauty in it is part of what I'm looking for out of my day.
What is success?
It's heavy. The privilege to get to see your ideas play out in real life.
Thanks for checking out this week's episode of Idea Generation, featuring Mario Carbone. Check back next week as I sit down with visionary street artist Futura. And thanks to our partners at Shopify for making all this happen. Check out their services at shopify.com/idea.